Succession number 27226, reel 17.
Line and hook, reel 17.
Right. Now, Surya C.C. was quite an important boy because he was young son of an upcountry chief at Bow Upcountry. And time came when he was entitled to leave. And so he went on leave to go up country. Now, how does a West African go up country, which is what, 60, 70 miles away, for a fortnight's leave? He can only walk. He can get a hitch on a train. There are trains which run for part of the distance. Or he can scrounge a lift, or he walks. Quite an exercise in itself. And he set off to go home to West Africa. See his dad. It was his own birthday, I think, as well. And he went up country, and when he got there, he was already established in menage a single menage in the base camp where he was. And when he got up country, his father had given him one of his old wives, not his old wives, but his younger wives actually, but a spare one, because apparently the chiefs gather wives as a sort of hobby or something like that. And Suri went up country to see his dad. And he was there for a little while. He called, visiting his friends on the way. He slept with his friends' wives all the way up, you know, and had a bit of a ball. He hitched lifts, he got rides, and generally, but he had something like 60, I think 60 to 80 miles, I can't remember, but a hell of a long walk to get up to see his dad. So he gets there, he enjoys the trip, but he hasn't much time to stay with him because he's got to come all the way back again. The father gives him a wife. He thinks about me. He thinks I've got to bring his boss master something back. So he brings back a chicken and he sets back to walk. Now, he walks all the way back from Bow up country to Hastings, Sierra Leone, with his wife, new wife, which he didn't want. And he decided when he came back. And the aspects of the journey back are almost secondary. He was stopping often with, you know, generally getting back. But the main thing about it was that he was coming back to the camp with a chicken for me, live, which he carried all the way like a handbag upside down with its legs tied together for all that time, probably for 2 or 3 days with his wife. And he arrived back in the morning to find me asleep in my bed, with a mosquito net on, and we are free, you know, we're pretty chatty. He thought, what a good idea, and he brought me my present and stuck it on the mosquito net, and I've seen a chicken fly upside down in a mosquito net. That was my present, which was a pretty skinny chicken when we gave to the cook, and we probably ended up as our food, but that was his present for me, brought it all the way back. But the other thing was, he got a wife, and she was not what he wanted, he didn't want it. And he gave her to me. When I told him, I said, sorry, I can't have a wife. I'm married. I'm only allowed one, unlike you. I said, we can't do anything about it. So, now, this is a naughty bit, but okay, it's what's the word, the French word, la vraie, vive vraie, or something, the true life. She came back to us. She's a beautiful West African, educated to English standards. She was like Sori, she could speak good English. And she was rather nice. And there was a problem here, because what could we do with her? Because Sori didn't want her, I couldn't have her. And we had surplus packing cases for the aircraft. So we made her a hut outside the airfield, and just as a bit of a hobby, really. So she could set herself in there, away from the thing, and she set it up as a brothel. And she started a brothel. Now, one aspect, we can stop here, because one aspect of life in West Africa for the boys was pretty horrible. if they went ashore, there was only women. The women were West African, there was diseases and everything else. They all were issued with condoms and could go ashore and do what the hell they liked. But this was here on site. And so the boys on the site used to use this girl as her brothel, and she bought other girls, supplied with condoms, so it was clean. This was done with the knowledge of the MO who examined the girls regularly, and with the CO of the camp. So what happened was that this turned out to be a place of pleasure, for want of a better word. What was needed for all the troops who were living in, you know, young lads, pretty reliable, and that worked, and it stayed, and she ended up with a store, a business, and everything else, and built up a little business of her own as a fishy mummy, mama, really, with a brothel and everything else, and did very well for herself. And when I left it, it was thriving. It was a good business. Wasn't doing anybody any harm. These boys paid the bob or took them. They didn't really threaten us or something like that. You know, just went and got rid of the problems. So here we have now a situation where outside the airfield, not in the control of the airfield, we have established sort of a civilized way of life for people who are very, very deprived on the field. They knew what it was there, knew what to do. And these boys, to give some idea of how they lived in huts, Nissen huts, really. We lived in concrete. We were, our plugs were concrete. And theirs must have been the same, because we were also taking into the airfield while we were there. The BOAC flights came into Hastings as the terminal port. So we got a lot of civilians coming into West Africa, and they went ashore, they did the whole thing. They used all the facilities, used our messing. And at the end of the day, when they finally closed Hastings, when the war had moved on, there was a problem because the mess had so much money got from taking the passengers in from Freetown. So here we have a different situation now. We've got a commercial situation where we've got rice for the boys, we've got a brothel just outside the door, and we've got a community that can live with itself. It was stable, and nothing clever about it at all. It was just a realistic appraisal of what life was like in this part of the world at that time. And it went on for, well, it was going when I left, though it wasn't long after, I think about 6 months afterwards, I think that Freetown Hastings was closed. So it was a working operation. When I left, I handed this over to a New Zealander who took it over, because the airfield was being run down and it was being reduced to care and maintenance. And so we found ourselves, before I left, with all the works department people on our books to look after, because they were malaria spraying, oil spraying, grass cutting and the like. And that contract was paid for, and we had the boys to do what we like with. They were paid. We got the money from selling the rice and everything else. But so they were happy, and they were tagged on to the boys in the uniform who were living in their squat. They got plenty of food. They were well paid, and they were doing all the work. So it was an organisation that was just round Hastings, really. It was quite useful. And when I left it, it was making money by the sale of the rice, which the laddie took over. And I met him later on, and he passed it over to somebody else, and he made a bob or two out of it as well. He was doing quite well. No harm to anybody. It was just looking at the economy of the place to make everybody. People would look at it now and say, "What? How are we doing that for?" You know, but it was a natural thing to do in those circumstances, on top of which we only flew probably, what, on an average 2-3 hours a day, one or two anti-submarine for the convoys. So we had nothing to do.
It sounds to me, though, you're actually providing facilities for the troops, in a sense, which is what you would do in any location, even with British troops, isn't it?
That's right. We just, what we did, we went into a situation where I had suddenly 400 native boys and available later on all the works boys thrust into my charge, really, what it amounted to. And so we built an office for them so they could, any complaints and anything like that, that was something we didn't have. I don't know where the squadron office was. But it was obviously in the mess, because we had mess. I had some photographs of what went on in the mess. We were feeding and we dressed in uniform and all the whites and everything else. Malaria was always a problem, of course, and I never had malaria when I was out there, and I don't think any of our lads did, because we weren't allowed to have mepocrin. We could only have quinine, and the only way you could take quinine was with gin, I suppose. So everybody was drinking gin and quinine, really. I never had... if you wrapped up at night, in the critical time, you know, about from 5 o'clock till seven, we wore mosquito boots, jungle boots, and long trousers, and long sleeves anyway. We all had silk flying gloves, in flying gloves that we used to wear as well. So most of us did that at night, just as simple protection against mosquitoes, and bloody things are biting you anyway, and it kept malaria away. But the one thing was that we couldn't have mepocrin, and so you had to consume quinine. Quinine is not pleasant at all, it's not nice. If we could have had tonic, you know, bottles of tonic, that would have been the better way to do it. But that was something, again, because mosquitoes were always there, always operating, and I don't know of all our crowd, I don't know of anybody who had malaria. Though Godfrey Parish had it when we were in Ceylon later on. But we kept clean of it. And I think we had a healthy lifestyle, a tropical lifestyle maybe, running free. We weren't bedeviled by rules and regulations.
What would your daily routine be like?
Well, we first of all, the primary requirement was flying. And so... we'd fly. I would look after the boys, and I had the office, so I had problems there. Also, we all had duties, office duties, by virtue of a ship in operation. And I used to have the crew boys, and it was the office for the crew boys. And I remember one particular day, indicative of naval life proper, was we had a blacksmith on board the... why we're blacksmith, I don't know. Probably the Navy thought we'd report aeroplanes and hammers, but that's by the way. But he was entitled, by being tropical, 2 pints of beer a day, and nobody would give him it. And he was only an able seaman, and he wanted a drink, and he broke camp 2 or 3 times. It was not a happy bunny. And this is indicative of also of how you can manage situations that, if they're not looked after in an asymmetrical way, change people's lives. Now, this boy bloke came, and he was arrested, and he was put in a slammer. They had a slammer there. I never actually saw it myself, and I was duty boy, and he was brought up in front of me for breaking camp. He was a big lad. He was a bit of a problem. And he was not a pleasant boy. He was going to do everybody to death when he came into the place. And to cut a long story short, he brought in front of me, well hung over, having drunk native paddy when he went ashore. And he told me what his problems were. That he was entitled to a pint of beer, and he wasn't getting it. And if he could have his beer, it'd be no problem at all. And I'd heard these stories from many people. I thought, well, that's a lot of bull. But it went on and on about this, and he was going to have a hard time. I could see there was an accident going to happen again, because if he wasn't going to get his beer, he was going to be said. So I said to him, I can't remember his name now. Doesn't make any matter. I've got a photograph in the book. I said to him, not to worry. He said, if you behave yourself and don't break camp, you can come round to the wardroom and they will give you 2 pints of beer every day. And it's down to me, it's there for you. And it was local beer that was brewed away, so there's no problem. And there was never any problem after that. But in between times, he chased me around the bloody world. He was going to do me to death at one time, until he caught him and dragged him back again and read the Riot Act and resolved it by giving him just a couple pints of beer a day. Oh, irrational, but that was the way it was. He was never a problem from that day to this, and he was always polite to me. He was never going to kill me or anything. And he drank his fair share. We got him beer. We could always get beer for him. But he didn't go ashore, didn't break camp, wasn't arrested. And when he went ashore, if he went ashore, he didn't get pissed out of his mind. He just drank a fair share, and that was it. Another problem solved.
Was there any problems with discipline with your native troops?
Yes, there is. An interesting one. Yes. Theft was something that was not looked upon very well. And I can't remember the details of this, but that's, again, in the book. Something was stolen. It's very hazy, this now. And it was put down to a Nigerian boy, to tell you the difference to the Nigerians, who had himself his own little hut, which was when I went to see him back, and I had to go and arrest him. And I remember this from day one, because he was a good, clean lad, smart as paint, and there was no reason why he should have been treated like I treated him, or anybody treated him at all. But he was suspected of stealing something from another one of the natives, and they were always doing it any time. And I wasn't realistic, I didn't understand these things at all. But he was due to be arrested and picked up, so I went to arrest him. He was rather distressed about the whole thing, and tied his hands together with a rope, and took him all the way through the village to be incarcerated wherever they incarcerated these boys. And I remember that, and I remember it to my dying day. And it was the most disgraceful thing I could have done to anybody, because I couldn't do it any other way. I had to arrest him. But that boy was somebody to be proud of. He was a nice, clean lad, arrested on suspicion, and we took all the heavy hammering of the Navy to go and arrest him and take him through the village and everything else, protesting all the way. And I can't tell you what the end of that story was. I can't remember. All I can remember was that I arrested him and handed him over to the police, or whoever they were at that time. It's just gone out of my mind, probably justifiably. But it was a shameful thing to do. It was disgraceful. But that was the sort of thing you got involved in, you see. You could find yourself doing things that were not nice by your standards. And you said, go and arrest a bloke. And it was your job to do it. And you went and did it. And you say, well, you've got to be arrested. And you did it the quietest possible way. And walked him all the way through the village. You didn't, manhandle him all the way through. And he walked all the way through with a certain dignity in it as well. And it was a nasty thing. It was very unpleasant. I always remembered it. So I don't know what happened to him now. I can't remember.
So theft was a problem. Was there any other problems?
There was, yes, interesting one too. When I first went out there, I had taken with me my father-in-law's 4.45 revolver, which was mine, personal property. And when I went there, the theft was quite a prominent thing. In the office cabins were always, and they used to come in like thieves in the night. They could appear and disappear like a shadow. And I did something. I said, I don't want any stolen. And I said, if anybody does, I've got this under me. I put it underneath my pillow. Nobody ever came near my cabin. Nobody ever touched my toilet. There were occasional raids on other cabins, little bits. What was unimportant to us was quite important to some of the natives that pinched it. But that, and I can't remember whatever happened to that 4.5, because I must have sent it home with my kit, because my kit went home at a couple of stages on, because I drew an Italian Beretta for another exercise, so I didn't have a 4.5 anymore for a long time.
But it dissuaded anybody wanting to thief.
Oh, it kept quiet. Everybody knew. They knew. They knew that there was, they had gone underneath my pillow. They had gone round the place. Don't go there, he'll shoot you.
Could you use that to your advantage, obviously passing on one story to one person to get a message around amongst the troops?
I can't think... I can't think of any particular application of that. But there's no question, because when the rice started to come in, the people knew the rice was coming in before I did. That was... I said I was going to get some rice for you. They knew that Suri knew I'd flown up country to get the rice. I said they're going to get some rice, Suri. And yakety-yakety-yak. So the first lot that came in was pinched. They got into... They broke into the bloody hut, which we didn't lock very much, took all the flaming rice, and I had to pay for it, you know? In fact, if I hadn't been able to get another load quickly and sell it, wouldn't have been able to pay the paybook to pay the... But we were a rascally bunch, really, but... We're finding our wings, I suppose.
What was mess life like?
Oh, very pleasant. That was very pleasant indeed. We ate well. The food was superb. In fact, I think the best ice cream I've ever had was made by a Navy cook. There was a Navy cook in charge of Navy boys. And that was made with carnation milk or evaporated milk. But we could only have one helping of it. We couldn't get any more. And he was clever, because I always remember when he did this to us, he did it with crystallised glass. He put a glass and put in sugar around it as well and did all sorts of things. He was a clever cook, I'll tell you. And the food, a curry, a West African curry, is like something you never had. It's different from Indian curries. We used to have a West African curry with all the fruit and all the things you could think, and christenum, about 40 different things on the table, which you doled into your curry. It was a delight. So we lived well. We lived very well.
What about alcohol?
We had it. I didn't drink, you see. That was my problem. I never drank. I think the boys used to take a standard tot of gin for a sundowner for anti-malaria, but it never bothered me at all. I never drank at all. We didn't have never any real problem. That they had their share, they drank what they wanted to drink. I didn't see it as I never saw it as a problem in the mess at all.
And flying, you mentioned obviously the two sorts of things that you're doing, the anti-submarine patrols and the target towing. How are the anti-submarine patrols organised? What kind of thing would you do with those patrols?
Well, you were told that there was a convoy coming in or coming right out, and you'd be told to go and meet the convoy and just circle it, that's all. You'd circle... usually round and round, just watching about, I say, probably half a mile from seeing if there's any submarines around, because it's possible to see the shapes underneath. But we never saw anything at all, really. We had a bit of a hoo-ha with the RAF, who were shot down in a Catalina by a submarine, and they... I sent a walrus out to pick up the crew who were in a dinghy, and they refused to come back in the walrus. and it ended up not being flown, but in the walrus, and coming back in the walrus on the step. It just flew back on the water all the way back. And the Poles, the Polish crew in the Catalines, and that they must have been from Waterloo. Though, strangely enough, I must confess that I never saw them. I never saw any Catalinas flying when I was there. That's in a six-month period, which is rather strange. There were some aspects that are rather horrible. We had a Wellington come in, and where it came from, I don't know, because a Wellington... And I've never thought about this before, but it just occurred to me now. Where did it come from? But the people coming, we kept having airplanes coming. We had a lot of Liberators come in. They're another story. But this was when Wellington came in, and he took off with a crew from the airfield and his engine stopped, take off, and he could only land straight ahead, and he landed in the mangrove swamp, and nobody could get at them. There was no life on when we flew over it. There was nothing there at all. And they're probably still there. Nobody could get, never went to the centre of the mangrove swamp where this Wellington went down. That's one item. Another one where a Wellington came in, and where they came, they might have come across on the Freetown. They might have come across on the reinforcement route from America, because they came into West Africa. Yes, they could have come into Freetown rather than to Secondi on the Gold Coast. But he came in, and that was an unpleasant one. Now, you've probably never heard of this, but what did I call it? Lockheed. What did I say it was?
Liberator.
A Liberator. It was a twin-engined American aircraft, and the petrol tanks were immediately above the oleos, the wheels. And this one came into land, and he landed heavily, broke his wheel, it went through the thing, and the whole thing caught fire. And that was quite an incident. That was interesting. He got out. They got out of that. They were all right. There was another time when they came in, and there was a little nasty business. Somebody in a Liberator again, and somebody broke into it and stole a gun, a revolver. I don't remember much about that. I remember it as an incident. But the other one, of course, the real nasty, was my relief came. This is going on a little bit in time, but we'll get it out of the way. My relief came. And he'd never flown a biplane before. He'd never flown a Swordfish. And this is a terrible story, but it's fact. He was told to go and fly a Swordfish for familiarisation. And he was set up with a Swordfish with two depth charges on to take off, fly around, familiarise over the aircraft with two depth charges on it. This lad had never flown a biplane in his life. He might have flown a Tiger Moth, probably not. He might have been trained on other things, but never flown a biplane. And it's a big aeroplane, as a Swordfish. Now, he set off and flew away and flew around and came back to the airfield. And the airfield, I described it to you, was a long one runway and another roadway coming at a V to it, going into the main camp. And he was disorientated, got it all wrong, and he landed on that road. He didn't land on the road, he landed right at the far end, in the middle of the camp. He knocked down two telegraph poles, the wires came over the cockpit, caught fire, and the PO got, they got an award for it anyway, because he blew in there amongst all the telegraph wires and pulled him out, and he was badly burned. But there was two depth charges on it, and the thing was on fire, and we rolled one off into the ditch at the side, and the other one was taken off the bottom and rolled away. And this thing was very, very lucky. That could have gone off. The boys did very, very well. My relief, it's in the magazine somewhere, I got it down there, he was badly burnt. Purely and simply because he was doing what everybody was doing at that time when they first came out. Sitting in an aircraft, it's hot, pair of shorts, pair of boots, nothing else, caught fire, flash, bang, and he was dead. He got 85% burns. It lasted about 3 days, and I saw him in hospital. It wasn't a very happy sight, but it didn't mean anything to me. It was just somebody who had been badly burnt, and that was my relief.